All right. Let's get fired up here.
Maximum freedom. Read.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom. Read Rothbard.
Well, hello and welcome to the Actual Anarchy Podcast. This is the podcast where we talk about movies from a Rothbardian anarcho-capitalist perspective. And tonight, it is a sequel of sorts. It's a sequel not only to The Shining book, but also the film, the Kubrickian film, and in a very impressive feat of filmmaking. The movie we're talking about tonight is Dr. Sleep, and it sort of picks up on both of those and brings it to a pretty satisfactory closing. And you can find the show notes more for this one at actualanarchy.com/257. And before we introduce our wonderful guest, who has been with us a number of times in the past, or perhaps not, we will explain in a few moments, but Robert, how are things going over there? I understand that you are preparing for winter and might have to just shut it in, like in the Overlook Hotel.
Yeah, it's going to look like the Overlook at the end of this movie. Absolutely. Yeah, we might do a little brief shutter downer, which would be, I think, detrimental to the business in terms of keeping you in the eye of the customer. You know, there's a reason why all these big brands that everybody knows already continue to advertise all the time. It's because advertising works. It reminds the consumer, there they are, they got this new thing, they're still working to improve their business, they're looking to bring in new customers, all kinds of things. It's an important thing. And if we shut down, it'll hurt that. But the winters are here are really brutal. And My dainty finnas wouldn't mind a little bit of a break from the winter cold. We'll see how bad it is. I'm rooting for a mild winter, but I've seen many a snow apocalypse here I've been here for about 6 years now. So we'll see.
Man, time flies. I can't believe you've been there that long. Mm-hmm. And how dainty you are, because you're fragile in the winters and you don't like the heat either. And yet you choose to live in an environment.
Just the wimpiest little guy you've ever seen, apparently. I don't know. I get sick like all the time. It's weird.
Yeah.
Got sick the other day. It didn't last long. So maybe I'm just very robust in that sense, but I don't know.
Yeah. Well, we were talking a little bit about that in the pre-show bonus content, of which there's about 45 minutes between you and me and our guest who's going to be coming up in just a few minutes here. So why don't we get into that, Dr. Sleep, with our guest right after these messages. Hey everyone, it's Daniel Elwood and Robert Paul Johnson. We are the Last Nighters. You can find us at the Liberty Movement's YouTube channel and also at lastnighters.com. This is episode 200. It's a little bit of a celebratory number, I guess you could say. And so we're going to have a guest who is a special treat. He has satirically been on here, or this is a satirical appearance of him on the show. And his alter ego has been on here before, also known as the Professional Asshole. But tonight he is identifying as Alec Jones. And he has been on a number of times in the past. Alec, welcome back to the show. I'm gonna actually list the shows you've been on before: Professor Madman, Russia with Love, Edge of Darkness, Legends of the Fall, The Last Jedi, Planes, Trains, Automobiles, and 310 to Yuma. Welcome back to the show, Alec.
Guys, I really appreciate having me on. It's really great to be back. For anybody who doesn't know, I am Alex's significantly more based and red-pilled twin brother. He's a great guy. You know, he watches tranny porn on occasion, but you know, we won't fault him for that. You know, he just got subject. He was worn down by the globalists. They kept on coming after him, and he couldn't resist it for long. And thankfully, I have been able to resist it. I have been a light in a dark place for my brother, and he's a great guy. But, you know, don't give him your phone.
All right. And in honor of Obi-Wan Kenobi being in this film tonight, I would say the satire is strong with this one, Robert, wouldn't you say?
Yes, indeed. I'm enjoying this. As a former many year listener of your based, not so based twin brother, it's great to have you on. I haven't paid a whole lot of attention to Alex
in the
past like 15 years or so, but for a while there I was enjoying a lot of his stuff, and of course I followed his trials and tribulations these past few years with his being ejected from social media and then also losing his lawsuit for the Sandy Hook thing. It's all been quite disappointing.
Yeah, have you seen his Rogan and Tim Pool appearances? He's actually been on those a few times, and they are pretty enlightening, and I think opening up a lot of eyes. There's a bit of an awakening, I think, happening.
Oh yeah, Rogan's audience isn't just the toxic masculinity incel community that the left likes to paint him as. He has a huge audience, and it goes across. It's a broad spectrum kind of a thing. With all the different topics he covers, and having Alex on, you know, for a media that just demonizes him all day long, as he's just like the most dangerous person in the world, you get him on there, and he's nothing of the sort.
Yeah, well, you know, I really enjoyed my appearance with Malice on Tim Pool, and obviously we met each other through Rogan. And contrary to what anybody will tell you, I mean, there's a particularly podcast host that likes to, you know, go to bat for Malice, say he's not gay. He 100% is. I mean, he 100% is. He was really coming after me on my masculinity. I've been really up in the dose of Superman Vitality lately, and he was coming after me. I was shocked. But, you know, as I understand, I mean, I'm a red-blooded American male. I don't take any of the fake chemicals that they put out there. Stay away from tap water. So it's kind of only natural for a guy like him to come after me. But, you know, I don't fault him. But, you know, he did come after me. He's definitely gay.
All right. So I just want to point out that this show is entirely for entertainment purposes. Pure satire. In fact, every episode, Robert, I think you'd agree. It's mostly for ham-fisted entertainment. Emphasis on
mild entertainment. I wouldn't give us too much credit. Try.
All right.
You're probably the most entertaining podcast I'm aware of. I mean, really, honestly, you guys are the best.
I appreciate that. No, he's not aware of much. He lives in a cave.
That's true. I mean, I'm not going to lie. I'm a little retarded.
So. He's got all us right. On the Lifetime channel. That's all you got.
Well, I'm glad that you're back with us. And all your prior appearances were a lot of fun. And I highly recommend them if people haven't heard them before. So we'll have those listed on the show notes page at lastnighters.com/200. There's also plenty of bonus content available for people. If they go to our Patreon, go to lastnighters.com/Patreon, send some money our way, Federal Reserve notes, for as long as they're still worth anything. And we'll send you additional access to all sorts of good stuff. So with that, I think we're going to get underway here. And Robert, I want to have you cue up your noises there. One, two, three. What are we talking about tonight? Dr. Sleep, that's right. Okay, so how we start this off is with the old...
That's the death breath, by the way. I mean, I'm curious. Death breath, that's...
Right, it's so good you had to tell people what it was.
That's right.
All right. So Dr. Sleep, rated R, 2019 thriller / psychological horror film, 2 hours and 32 minutes in the theatrical cut. However, there is a director's cut which adds another roughly half hour, so it makes it a three-hour movie. I actually ended up watching both versions, and so I'll have a few things to say. Wow. This came out 2019, as we said. 7.3 out of 10 on that IMDb, 78% Rotten Tomatoes, 59% Metacritic, and 87% of Google users like it. The description reads, struggling with alcoholism, Dan Torrance remains traumatized by the sinister events that occurred at the Overlook Hotel when he was a child. His hope for a peaceful existence soon becomes shattered when he meets Abra, a teen who shares his extrasensory gift of the shine. Together, they form an unlikely alliance to battle the True Knot, a cult whose members try to feed off the shine of innocence to become immortal, also known as Adrenochrome. Came out November 8th, 2019, directed by Mike Flanagan, and has a box office of $72.3 million, which apparently was lower than expected, especially with decent critical reviews, and blamed on the length and the limited number of showings you can have in a day because of the length of the film. It's adapted from the novel, which was a sequel to The Shining by Stephen King, called Dr. Sleep. This is starring Obi-Wan Kenobi, among some lookalikes from the original cast of The Shining. So, Robert, let's go to you for your opening breath on Dr. Sleep.
Well, as you know, Daniel, I famously dislike The Shining. And correctly dislike The Shining. Thank you very much. And I told you about this film when I just stumbled across it one day. I think it was like on HBO or something in 2019. And I had a great time with it. And I was like, what is this? What? How come I'd never heard of it, first of all? And second of all, why is it good? And I maybe it didn't make enough money because of the lack of marketing, or maybe I was just under a rock at the time. I don't know. But I had a great time with this film. I'm surprised to hear that you and our guest also enjoyed this film. Being such Shining purists, this movie is such a departure in tone and structure and form from the original movie. This movie is more like kind of an action-y type movie mixed with like an X-Files episode. And I really enjoyed it. The cast is excellent. Obi-Wan, you get to know his character a lot. That's one thing that the original Shining movie failed flat on its face, is having likable characters and getting to know those characters. And this movie didn't do that at all. It actually showed people, you got to know them, you get to show how much they cared about each other. The only thing, I mean, maybe the movie probably had to trim some time. I think where he makes his best friend, the Alcoholic Anonymous friend guy, maybe he commits a little bit too easily to Dan's crazy mission in the film. Maybe that was left on the cutting room floor. Maybe that's in the director's cut. I don't know. But that felt a little bit too easy to go, oh, by the way, you know, we're just going to have this conversation behind a closed door, and you're just going to have to, as the audience, believe that it was really persuasive or something like that. Maybe he showed him, but I don't think he did. But I had it's a fun time. It's a very standard plot Hollywood type movie. Like, it has a big showdown at the end. There's even a shootout, which is kind of surprising. I was surprised, but I was just like, well, let's just get some rifles and we'll just shoot these guys. It's like, okay. I mean, that sounds like a pretty good play, especially when they're just going to stand there out in the open and then fire back with revolvers and pistols when you're hiding behind a tree from like 50 yards away. I think they're going to be, that's just like a turkey shoot. I mean, eventually they do seek some cover and whatnot, but I would think that, you know, if you're like these really, really long-lived psychic vampires, maybe you've developed some skills in the time you've been alive. I do like the idea that they said that they were rich and well connected, because that's one thing that the vampires in the Lestat, the Anne Rice movies, they do really well. It's like they've been around for hundreds and thousands of years, not hundreds of thousands, but hundreds and thousands of years. Mm-hmm. And they've had time to build wealth and establish many connections. And if you're going to go at these people, you're going to have to go at them fairly directly.
Right. Yeah, it's sort of like Groundhog Day, where Bill Murray repeats the same day over and over again. So he gets like super good at everything.
Yeah.
They've been around.
Like,
that
you
long.
Would, you would have so many talents and hobbies that you would just be amazing at if you're that long lived. I mean, we don't get an exact date as to how long the Mrs. Hat Lady has been around,
or
the other people, but the one guy, the old guy, is said to have been around since Roman times. So you would think, I mean, even though he dies during the film, just from old age, apparently.
Well, and the lack of fresh steam, fresh children blood.
But he just got some fresh steam.
Yeah, yeah, it gets a little muddy there, right? Like, they got that baseball kid and he was supposed to be pretty shiny.
Yeah.
But apparently that's like the best of what's left. So okay. The overall okay. Degradation.
So the whole world is kind of falling in. Yeah, she did talk about, the hat lady talked about, or the crow guy said, like, well, I don't know if it's Netflix or social media or whatever, but these kids aren't as shiny as they used to be. It's kind of a dig at modern entertainment, I suppose. But still, we get the idea that these people are very, very old. And it would have been nice to have seen some of skills and abilities that these people would have gotten over the centuries, as opposed to,
supernatural skills, but more like practical.
Just anything. Tactical, whatever. Like, you've been around for hundreds of years and you're just going to pull out a pistol when somebody's got a rifle at 50 yards? Maybe you've come up with something to deal with different situations. I don't know. Or just even had skills or talents. Like, they kind of looked like a circus. Mm-hmm. Maybe even have some kind of acrobatic abilities or something. I don't know. But
that would attract the kids too, you know?
There you go. See? Traveling circus. And then you got kids just coming to you.
Kind of does do that at the beginning when she has the magic trick.
She does. Yeah. She does in the Florida with the Violet Girl. That's true.
The reason I reached out to you guys like a year ago with this is because obviously, you know, I've been saying for 25 years that we are ruled by a satanic group of interdimensional psychic vampires who feed on the despair, especially of anyway, of people in general, but especially of the children. You know, and they that's why all the elites are so obsessed with making sure they control your kids. And this is exactly why. And what's really going on here is that Hollywood, at this point, they are so overconfident. They're so overconfident that they actually think they can get away with this. Like, they're basically just telling us what's going on, and they think they can get away with it. And it's up to people like you and me and other good Americans who, you know, embrace the spirit of 1776. It's up to them to make sure that they don't get away with it. They have to stand up and do what's right. And that's just the way it is. And I mean, you know, they have the steam in there, obviously, where they're like torturing the little kids and they're cutting them apart and stuff like that. And he's releasing the steam. Obviously, that's supposed to be a stand-in, like an analogical stand-in for adrenochrome, which, you know, the elites, they harvest it from kids so that they can stay young forever. And, you know, it's that life-giving substance. And it also has psychic abilities associated with it. So when you take it, you get high, you know, and you're able to communicate with other dimensions and get special knowledge. But, you know, the problem is that As they say, this stuff, it never works permanently, right? Like it will delay you. It'll keep you from getting old. I mean, like Joe Biden. I mean, like, it's a really good example. You know, it's like the guy's been old since he was 50. But because of the adrenochrome injections that they're giving him, you know, he's hanging along. He's hanging along a lot longer than he should have. I don't even know how his son Hunter's still alive. But, I mean, he's 50 years old and he looks not half bad for being, you know, 50, 51 years old. And smoking crack literally the whole time he's an adult. And he still looks like most guys at 38 or something like that. So, I mean, he's obviously on a pretty heavy adrenochrome regimen. But, you know, it's sooner or later, you can't escape. You can't escape justice. You can't escape God. He's coming after you. You know, and the guy who knew that best was Johnny Cash.
Johnny Cash. I do love me some Johnny Cash.
Don't throw that in. I don't know where that came from, but all right.
He's got the song, you know. It's actually originally Hank Williams song, but you know, he redid it like twice, once in the '60s and once in the '90s.
Okay. Well, we'll find that. We'll put it on the old show notes page.
So Daniel, I was expecting you to not like this movie.
Well,
as Snobby Bobby said, he hated this film, and you being the purist. So I need you to defend yourself, sir. I need you to tell me what you possibly even a little bit liked about this thing. I mean, it is based on Stephen King novel, and from the Wikipedia on the novel, it's pretty similar. Yeah. Obviously, there are some changes. Things are cut for time, that kind of thing. But it has the gist of the King novel. If someone were to pitch you a Shining sequel, is this a kind of how it would have gone, or what are you thinking here?
All right, so I have very convoluted and nuanced thoughts on this. I think that Kubrick's movie is genius because it has so much ambiguity and so much intention of throwing you down different rabbit holes. This one is genius in that how it reconciles both the Kubrick film and the Stephen King novels, both of them, The Shining and Dr. Sleep, because what they've done is they've melded them together, folded them together to create a film that actually is an extension of both in a way. The ending that we see in Dr. Sleep, the film, is actually the original ending of the novel of The Shining, where the Overlook Hotel burns from the overloading of steam
boiler,
the boiler. So the Doctor Sleep novel has a slightly different ending than what we see here, but this reconciles the ending that Stephen King never got from the Kubrick film, which he said he didn't like so much so that he made a TV miniseries version of his, which is god awful. So I found that I was really enjoying the nostalgic homages and callbacks to the original film. It is somewhat similar though to the Gus Van Sant remake of Psycho in that you're doing things as homage, but they're not quite as authentic or original because they are copies and facsimiles. They're intentional, and you're going to play a fine line whether you have completely new and unique visuals and characters or actors playing the characters, or you have like digitization to reincarnate a young Shelley Duvall or a young Jack Nicholson. So they kind of fit right in the middle where they had the sort of essence of them, but in new actors and actresses playing those roles. And I think convincingly enough to where you see this as a sequel to The Shining as a film, but then there's enough in there from the book, the original book and the Dr. Sleep book to satisfy King and King fans of the book. So in a way you sort of had this like pretzel effect of continuation of both of those divergent paths from the original Shining, and you bring them back on and fold them onto themselves. And that I think was pretty genius. It's hemmed in though. The genius was making that work. In the Kubrick film, the genius was exploding it out into possibility.
And in this, it was bringing it all together and having a satisfying ending.
Right, right. And being true enough to the source material to do it with respect and competence.
Yeah. Okay. Now, I think, isn't it King who once famously said he didn't like sequels and never wanted to do a sequel? Or is that somebody else that I'm thinking of?
I know he didn't like the Kubrick version of the film. I don't know what about sequels, because his, as Doc Brown, who has been a guest with us a couple of times in the past, and Alec, you know him as well, maybe not by that name, but he's an avid reader, and he was telling us how most of King's work is interrelated. There's a universe in which all those novels kind of fit. So maybe it's world building, like in the pre-show bonus content, we were talking about Tolkien being a great world builder. Maybe there's some world building there. There's It and It 2. I don't know if there's an It 2 novel.
No, it was just chopped in half. So It 1 and It 2 are both just It, but in pieces.
Okay. So I don't know, to answer your question, I'm not sure if King has a particular take on sequels, as it were, though he does write in sort of interconnected ways in his novel.
Okay.
Alec, do you have thoughts on this?
Yeah, well, Stephen King is a great guy. I know he comes off as like a super liberal guy on Twitter. That's really his cover, because he's actually trying to expose things. He really is. And that's why he's got all of his books, like his Dark Tower series and all that stuff. I mean, basically is a dimension traveling demons that come along and try to corrupt humanity. He's out there. He's absolutely trying to red pill people, to get people, but he has to have cover for himself. Otherwise, like, you know, for me, you know, the problem is, it's not so much. I'm willing to take heat. You know, I'm willing to be out there and take the heat, and you'll be the man they come to assassinate eventually. But the problem is a lot of people hate me. Right? I get that. Right? Like, I really speak uncomfortable truths, and that's just the way it is. They hate my guts. They're not going to listen to me, but they might listen to somebody who they think is on their side, and I think that could be Stephen King. So he's a great guy. And you know, a lot of this was because he did a lot of drugs back in the 80s too, especially he was really doing a lot of cocaine. But when he was doing a lot of cocaine, he also did some of the LSD, and that's when he got all the spiritual truths that he understood, and that's when he was able to start writing his books. And he did Tommy Knockers, and he did the Dark Tower series, and he started coming up with those ideas, and he came up with Roland. And you know, he's got Randall Flagg as the ultimate bad guy. He's like Satan, basically, and interdimensional psychic demon. I mean, that's where he comes up with the idea of these psychic families. He didn't actually have to come up with them. He knows that they exist because he's seen them. He's seen them when he's been, you know, tripping on DMT or something like that, trying to get to a higher plane of consciousness. And he's met the psychic vampires, and he knows that's how they operate. And he knows that they implant themselves in the high level of government, and that they go after the kids like this. So I'm glad that he's keeping a low profile, politically speaking. and he's able to rip people that way. It's going to come back in the future. It's really going to be beneficial in the future when we understand this kind of stuff. But for right now, you know, he's one of the good guys.
That and, all does make sense.
Continuing our satirical review of Dr. Sleep here, you brought up a couple of points. One is DMT, which always reminds me of Joe Rogan. And I think at pre-show, we were talking about how Rogan has really great conversations with a lot of really good guests. And
he's a really good guy, too. He's a really good guy.
Yeah, yeah. In several recent episodes, he had Alex Jones, your satirical half-twin brother, on, and that was really good. He also recently had on a very contrasting back-to-back. One episode was Alex Berenson, who was a former reporter for the New York Times, who got fired for speaking truths. And it's a really great episode. And then the very next one was Sanjay Gupta, who is this smarmy CNN medical guy.
He's absolutely one of the same. He's basically bought off. He's been bought off for 25 years.
And Rogan actually likes the guy. He stood up for him, defended him and whatever, and thinks he's a great guy. But the contrast between those two styles of interview and the responses to the questions, totally contrasting and different. And so it's a great way to like see how true journalism versus sort of this saccharine fake journalism and how it kind of plays out. A follow-up episode to that was Michael Malice, which was just recently. And on that, he actually talks about Gupta and how he has a lot of respect for him. Joe Rogan does in talking to Malice. So those are really good episodes worth checking out. The other thing you mentioned was that King was doing a little bit of the nose candy back in the day. And he was also a pretty heavy alcoholic in the 70s and 80s. And that was when he wrote The Shining in the 70s. And in the bonus content for Dr. Sleep, he says that when he wrote The Shining, it was about a father's descent into alcoholism and how it destroyed his family. And he felt that Dr. Sleep, which is what this so-named movie is to the novel, is the redemptive arc of that in the sun, in Danny Torrance, going through, you know, a trough of difficult times with alcohol and then recovering from it.
Well, that's why it's so important for us to continue on with our having families and stuff like that. You know, it's why they at least come after your families, because it's a thing that gives us not only something to look forward to or something to work for, an eternality, I guess you could say. Children, in a sense, they are dimensional beings themselves. When we birth them, they're dimensional beings because they come from the heavenly place and they come through the womb and they come out and they're spirits. So it's literally taking somebody from the heavenly place, another dimension, and through the process of the birthing process, they come out and they are now in the physical realm. So, I mean, we are all inherently spiritual, ultimate dimensional beings. That's ultimately our destiny. We're going to go be in these alternate dimensions. But that's why the elites don't want you to have kids, because when you have kids, you realize there's this spiritual dimension to your life and you have to participate in it. You can't disconnect yourself from it the way they're trying to. They want to live forever. They want to live forever here in the physical realm. And, you know, they want to keep people from going and ascending to the spiritual realm, to the alternate dimension realm, where there's actual peace, joy, and tranquility.
All right. It's interesting you bring that up, because I have the documents right here. We go to Business Insider, a story on human life span limitless. Maximum age debate rages. So in the news recently, there's talk of whether humans can live beyond the traditional human lifespan. And this film, of course, we have interdimensional beings kind of doing that, feeding off of the young and gifted in this adrenochrome fashion.
Well, and it doesn't have to be adrenochrome. I mean, adrenochrome will make you live for a long time and give you special powers and give you all these insights. But, you know, because of the influence of the elites on the degradation of our culture, you know, they've been feeding us shit for thousands of years. And I mean, I understand. I mean, I'm a little chubby myself, but, you know, it's more of a choice. But because of that, you know, our DNA has over time degraded. It's not to say it's irrecoverable. It can be recovered at any time if we're willing to. But the elites are definitely standing there trying to make our lives shorter, more miserable, with no children, living in a box, you know, eating bug meat.
And, owning nothing, but being
owning nothing and being happy about it. Exactly. But, you know, it absolutely is the case. We could all live for a very, very, very long time if we wanted to. It's just a matter of getting our genetics in order. We can do it. Just start by eating right, getting your super male vitality in. Really got to do that. You know, stuff really, I mean, it's really worked wonders for me. I mean, I'm out of shape right now because I'm getting close to 50, but you know, when I was 42, 43, I got in like the best shape of my life. You know, when I was just back on Superman Vitality, there's been pictures online. I'm sure you've seen them. Good in those pictures. I mean, toner or tan in like a month. It's great.
All right, spray tans do wonders.
Yeah. No, I don't know spray tan stuff. I mean, that stuff's toxic. That's made by the globals.
Yeah, you bring up an interesting point again, and this is not related to the film in any way whatsoever, but I've often argued that people's lifespans have been improved by the standard of living being improved by specialization, division of labor, the Industrial Revolution, the offshoots of that, people having access to hygienic, clean water, better nutritional foods, exercise, sunlight, more leisure time, things like that. And lifespans have improved, you know, including with some, you know, medical and traumatic medical interventions, things like that. But at the same time, we also see all sorts of stories about how we're being fed, you know, corn syrup and vegetable oils, which are like terrible for you, and all these things that actually cause all sorts of heart and cancer issues, or potentially do, that are shortening lifespans. So I'm wondering if there's sort of this countervailing force that has improved lifespans, you know, up into the 80s and 90s, right? I think the average age of death in the United States right now is close to 80 years old. 50 years ago is like 65 or 70. So there has been an improvement. Yet at the same time, there's been a lot more ingestion of chemical-laced foods and less nutritious foods and things like that. So I just wonder how much better things could be had we had a more natural diet, and still having the more cleanliness and the more leisure time, more exercise, vitamin supplements, nutritious food, etc.
Taking all the good, none of the bad.
Right.
You know, it's important to note that there's been no moments since biblical times. You gotta make sure that you deal with your physical waste as safely as possible. It's been around since biblical times, and I mean that's what a lot of the biblical law is: just make sure that you maintain physical and social safety. You know, vaccines, they can be helpful, but they're actually generally, in my opinion, a bad thing. So a really great example is everybody thinks polio vaccine, stock polio vaccine, stopped polio. It didn't. Chlorinating pools is what stopped polio. We started chlorinating pools because we didn't have wastewater treatment back in the 30s and 40s. Not very good stuff anyways. So most people were just, you know, swimming in bad water and had, you know, wastewater in it. And, it was when we started chlorinating the water, when we started, you know, boiling it, when we started dealing with things, that's when we started having safe aerosolized or aerated breakdowns of fecal matter. That's when we started having actual improvements in health. The Salk vaccine helped alleviate the symptoms of polio, but it actually did not, it didn't actually cure polio. You still got polio. It's just that you had antibodies in order to deal with the symptoms. So, and then people don't know this, but there were actually bad versions of the Salk vaccine. I got the papers, and I can send you the stuff, but there were alternative competitor vaccines to the Salk vaccine, and they didn't do it right, and it actually ended up killing a lot of people, like thousands of people in one city, and you know, paralyzing many more, and they finally got off of it. But if, you know, if you were sitting there in 1954 and you were a parent and you had the option between a couple of vaccines, you would not have known a priori or just based on any sort of knowledge that you should be taking the vaccines. Like, they were experimental back then, and some people took them and died, right? The fact that the Salk vaccine ended up being moderately okay and even relatively successful does not mean that it's the vaccines that actually stop polio, okay? Boiling water, chlorinating pools, aeration of wastewater, that's what did it, you know? So anyways, and I mean, it's amazing to me that, you know, what's being shared between this movie and is the there's actual power, there's psychic value and psychic power in the human soul. It in and of itself, it's funny. Recently, my wife, she was rewatching like this manga series or manga series. I don't know what they're called. They're like some Japanese thing. I don't really watch myself, but it's this thing called Full Metal Alchemist or something like that. And the whole story, I kid you not. Again, another example of the elites. They cannot keep from exposing themselves, and people know about it. The whole story is literally about like this little demon character who was summoned through satanic rituals, blood, like literally blood magic. That's the part of the story. He was summoned through blood magic. He comes from an alternate dimension, and he starts giving perverted knowledge to mankind. Now, the perverted knowledge is almost exclusively for the purpose of helping the king of this particular country to live forever, right? And he's like, I want to live forever. You know, so how can I actually live forever? I mean, not just for a long time, like with adrenochrome or something like that, or drinking good bloods or having, whatever, like having Silicon Valley or something like that. But actual, like, how can I live forever? And so this demonic character who's been born through magic, basically says, okay, so what you're going to do is you're going to sacrifice all the people of your country, and you're going to concentrate their soul energy into a philosopher's stone, right? Just like in Harry Potter. And that's going to let you live forever. But he tricks the guy, and he actually takes it for himself, and he builds himself like a body. And he goes on, and this evil demon blood character, who he's not the star of the show, he's the bad guy. He literally goes and he makes a new country, right? This new country he makes fake humans called homunculuses. And homunculus is an old Latin word, means little person. It's like the man in the eye. So you understand. So the homunculus was the reflection of a person you see when you look into somebody else's eye, you see your own reflection. And people thought that was the soul trapped inside you. And so the homunculus is actually the trapped soul. It's a trapped soul. It's really what it is. It's a trapped soul from, that got trapped in the philosopher's stone. It gets used to make a fake person. These fake people, they were used to run the whole country. They ran the whole country for like 400 years just for the eventual purpose of sacrificing the whole country, which is, 50, 60 times bigger. They end up sacrificing the whole country through this blood magic stuff, so that the demon bad guy could absorb all their power and then eventually ascend to the plane of God and conquer God. That was the whole point of the whole show, was he wanted to conquer God. And we got the hero, the good guy who was like an alchemist, basically, who stopped him. He stopped him, and he actually ended up stopping him by sacrificing his ability to do magic. It's crazy stuff. So, but it's funny because this show, it's like you think of it as like a kid's show because it's like animated and all this stuff. It's actually got, in my opinion, the best. It's got the best representation of what the state is. The state exists solely for the purpose of sacrificing people so they at least can live forever. That's the way it is. It's the way it always has been. Ever since the Indus Valley Civilization, I was recently watching a video about Indus Valley Civilization, how the people who escaped from the Indus Valley Civilization. I had for a really, really long time thought that the Polynesian people originally came from like southern India, or perhaps Taiwan, and they had moved their way eastward across the Pacific until they got to South America, because their genetic lineage is shared by the Incans in Peru and also in the Mayans up in Mexico. And I thought for a long time that they had sailed eastward, which is very difficult to do across the Pacific, because the Pacific, all the prevailing winds are westward to Australia. The trade winds move west. So it's very difficult to sail east across the Pacific, but you can do it. And the Polynesians are obviously really, really famous for having yams. But yams actually originated in Chile. They're like a South American thing. So I thought originally they had made it all the way east from like Taiwan, stopping off on these islands and getting to South America and then getting the yams and coming back. But actually, apparently, that's not the way they went. I was confused on this, because at the same time, there are Polynesian-speaking people in Madagascar, right? Like in Madagascar, the language is Polynesian, and it's really, really old Polynesian, which I thought was surprising too. So apparently, I got it wrong. They actually didn't go eastward across the Pacific. They went westward, because it's easier to sail west. In fact, all the prevailing winds always go west. They sailed from basically the Indus Valley Civilization like 8,000 years ago. They sailed down, stopped off Madagascar, planted their stuff. They still have a Polynesian language there. They went around the Horn of Africa, went up the Atlantic, across the Caribbean. They planted off people there, some of the Taino and all that stuff. They went, became the Mayans, moved down, became the Incans. And then eventually when there was war broke out, they sailed from Peru all the way back across the Pacific Islands and repopulated those. And it's interesting because Hawaiian is actually is the language on the planet that has the smallest number of phonemes. That's basically vowels and letters and sounds and stuff like that. Whereas classic Polynesian languages, the oldest ones, have like 30 or 40. So it's a lot more. But it's still Polynesian languages. Anyways, all that is really interesting, because the genetic haplotypes from the Indus Valley Civilization, you would expect them to only stay generally in like southern Iran or something like that. But no, they're actually found. Second highest concentration of them is in Peru, right? So, and somehow, we don't know when, but ancient Persians found their way to Peru and Mayan. And it's the same genetic haplotype. And the place where it's found after that is in New Zealand, among the Maori. It's crazy. And as all these people share this same crazy stuff, like they all have the same basic idea that, like, the reason the Mayans and the Incans and all that stuff submitted to like the white Spanish conquistadors because they thought they were gods. Everybody's heard that in their history books. It's true. And the Maori actually did it too. The reason why the Maori are all Mormons, if you didn't know, they're all Mormons, is because they had an ancient legend that a white guy was going to show up and give them a new truth. And in the 1850s, some Mormons showed up speaking their language and gave them a new truth. And they were like, oh my God, that's it. So anyways, yeah, crazy stuff right there. But hey, the whole point is that the history of civilization is blood sacrifice from the state going throughout history and people fleeing blood sacrifice. That's always the way it is. The state, it gets established, it starts sacrificing people in mass in order for the elites to live forever. People run away from it, they go set up new civilizations, and that's it.
All right. So Alec, we gotta control you down here like Michael Malice did with Alex on the Tim Pool show. So
I did a little cocaine before we got on.
Yeah, we gotta bring it back to Dr. Sleep. All right, but I think that might have been the director's cut version of how you tie this back into Dr. Sleep, which was about the sacrifice of the children so that these psychic vampires could live forever.
Yeah.
So thank you for that little sideline. Normally, we would save content for that for bonus content, but it's perfect in this one.
It's flawless victory, Alec.
Like I said, sometimes I really just go on. It's good that you rein me in. I really is, because sometimes I have trouble focusing. I have trouble concentrating. Like I said, when I was on Joe Rogan, I got hit in the head a few times when I was a kid. Alex and I were both there. He got hit in the head. I got hit in the head. And I was a really, really smart kid. And I guess I'm really still kind of a smart guy. But, you know, like I have trouble concentrating. Sometimes I just go on forever. And, you know, cocaine doesn't help.
So, Robert, bring us back to the movie a little bit. Go ahead. You got something to say.
No, I was going to ask you the question. You said that you watched both versions of the film, and I wanted to hear what the differences were between the director and the theatrical.
Okay, well, going into it, I was expecting there to be additional scenes or something like that, and there was maybe one or two additional scenes, but for the most part, it was just shortening all the existing scenes down in time a bit, I think, to get the runtime down for theatrical to a more reasonable amount.
It wasn't a whole lot more content.
There is a little bit more. It's just bits and pieces here and there in every scene. I think every scene is probably cut just a little bit in the theatrical cut. But the red bathroom, that is a scene that is not in the theatrical, but it is in the director's cut. And they built the Overlook sets on a soundstage, and every set had to be built, shot, dismantled, and then the next set was built.
In the same place. Okay.
In the same place. So the red bathroom, you see it in the bonus content. And you're like, what? There's no red bathroom in the movie. Director's cut. But it's pretty amazing how much work went into creating each set. They shoot the scenes in it, dismantle, and then rebuild the next set. So they do that for the Colorado room, the hallway that the two girls are in, the apartment that they're in the Overlook that has the same, you know, smashed doors and all that stuff. They replay a lot of those scenes, which I felt like was kind of the cool homage that sort of immerses you back into the film. And in fact, it opens with Danny going through the hallways with the lock and key carpet and ending up at, I think, room 237, which is very similar to what happens in Psycho 2, where they open with the shower scene from the original Psycho from 1960. They replay that to bring you back into the same feeling as the original film. So they did that in Psycho 2 from 82.
Okay, so if you were to recommend one version, which would it be, and why?
Well, I think that the Dr. Sleep director's cut version, those extensions do help. It does help to clarify that they are seeking to, the True Knot are seeking to get this white whale of a girl. This Abra is the most steam they've seen in generations. And so rather than turn her, because she would then be more powerful than even Rose the Hat, she doesn't want that. She doesn't want anyone there who could potentially usurp her power. She's clearly the leader of that group. And they also don't want to kill her and just like exploit that resource in a very short amount of time. So they're actually exhibiting time preference here, where they want to milk her like a cow and extend her life and feed on her for decades. And that,
so
that
keep her as some sort of a prisoner while they... Right.
Sort of an on-demand steam, because they've been starved for steam for a long time. Like we were talking about earlier, you know, the Netflix generation, fewer and fewer kids have shiny and less shininess.
Right.
And so that's more spelled out in the director's cut, in that that's their plan. That's Rose the Hat's and the True Knot's plan. I think that they sort of allude to it in the theatrical cut, but it's not as abundantly clear. Like, they beat you over the head with it in the director's cut. Like, we want her because she will solve the problem of us not having steam for a long
time. So in the director's cut, did you feel the runtime? Did you feel that the extra content and the extra information was worth the added time?
I think it's a better version. I do. But I can also see why they wouldn't want to have a theatrical release of 3 hours. Okay. It's hard to sit still for 3 hours and keep track of a movie. And it's also something you don't want to like have to get up halfway through and go to the bathroom. And that's one of the great things. I actually mentioned this to my wife, is that this came out in the fall of 2019, pre-pandemic. If this had come out like 6 months or a year later, I think it would have been maybe the 3 hour cut, because it's streaming, right?
And right. So, who cares about theater times?
Yeah. Right. And then it changes the story. I think it makes it a little bit more full and more robust. And yeah, it's definitely worth watching. I don't know if you actually have access to it, because it's in the
I do not.
Somewhere, but it doesn't have theatrical cut or the director's
cut. Directors, yeah.
Yeah, it's a bonus in the Vudu version that I have.
Okay.
But yeah. So anyway, if you have the means, I do recommend checking it out.
Is it worth watching it a second time? Like, if I ever have the inkling of watching this film again, I would probably, if I had the means, seek out the director's cut. But is it worth it for me right now, having already watched the theatrical?
I had the same question, and I chose wisely and watched the theatrical and then the director's cut. So wife and I watched theatrical over the weekend, and then we were like, oh, there's this director's cut. You want to watch it? And she's like, yeah, sure. She liked the theatrical well enough to watch again. And mm-hmm. I liked it as well. Though again, I don't like it in the same way that I like The Shining. The Shining just has so much that you can read into, and I just love the craft of it. This one,
You didn't see this movie as a betrayal in any way, because I could see some diehard Shining fans going, "Well, this is nothing like The Shining. This is this departure."
They attempt to do the homage thing, right? So it's like the Gus Van Sant version of Psycho, where they like literally reshoot some of those scenes from the same angles and things like that. When we go back to the Overlook, you still got the tracking shot from the helicopter with the newer vehicle, the Toyota Camry or whatever it is.
Right, but the tone and the feel is totally different.
Right, but it's homage. Yes, it is different. It's far creepier in The Shining. The Shining has far more sinister feel to it.
Right.
This movie, yeah, it has bad people doing bad shit or bad, you know, whatever they are, demons, psychic vampires.
They're creepy people, but it's not like spooky scary. It's right. Just like these are some villains out to get the good guys.
Yeah, so it loses a little bit of that luster for me. But as far as like the craft of like bringing together these disparate narratives and satisfying them all, it was pretty impressive.
You liked how it turned out. You thought this was a satisfying ending to the Shining-verse.
It does destroy one thing, though, and that is the Wendy theory. Have you seen the Wendy theory?
I remember you sending me a Wendy theory video, and I said, seems like a bit of a reach.
I enjoyed the Wendy theory. I don't know if it was during this episode tonight or in the pre-show bonus content available for Patreon supporters, where we were talking about alternate version of Lord of the Rings. What if Gandalf took the ring? And there it spins out for a 20 or 30 minute thing, and I think it's actually pretty good. The Wendy theory.
Where Wendy's the one going crazy.
Wendy's the one going crazy, and we see it from her perspective, and there are enough tells in the movie to where you could credibly say, okay, when we see it from this perspective, this is Wendy's view. And then when we see it from this other perspective, it's the alternate view that we're supposed to pick up on the initial watching of The Shining.
But if I recall, it was like furniture that's not there anymore. Mm-hmm. The light switch has been moved. Little details that a master craftsman like Kubrick probably did intentionally.
Right.
Right.
Right. And so it's where Wendy's the one actually attacking Danny, but she's going crazy and is projecting that upon Jack.
Indeed.
But then
this
Sleep destroys
Sleep comes
narrative.
Around. It's definitely Jack who was going crazy.
Right. From alcohol and the evil of the building.
Right.
And I don't know if,
and the fact that he lived with his mom for a happy time after the fact of the move.
I think it's important to remember, guys, that there is actual evil in this world, and it does physically manifest, and it can affect you on a personal, spiritual, emotional level. And I mean, I never mess around with Ouija boards and stuff like that, just for that reason. You know, I never try to summon demons, even though I've read books on how. I refuse to do it. So I think it's important to remember that he was actually being affected. It's not just pure alcohol on his part. We've all had alcohol, we've been drunk. We don't go that crazy, okay? He's going crazy because he's got an actual demon trying to, like, possess his soul.
Okay, all right.
Right.
And that demon is manifested in the Overlook Hotel.
That's right. And
that gets a little fuzzy for me in Dr. Sleep, where they're like, well, there's these, the True Knot people, they're psychic vampires, and then there's evil places that shine, and then there's kids who shine that are feasted upon by the evil psychic vampires. But did Jack Torrance shine, or was he just affected and gone mad by the shining of the Overlook in the original The Shining?
In the book, according to the Wikipedia, in the Dr. Sleep book, according to the Wikipedia, it said that Jack was the original father of both Danny and he was Abra, yeah.
Oh,
so he must have been super shiny, at least a little bit.
Okay, so he's the father of Abra. That's interesting, because in the movie we have a father who is not Jack by any stretch.
Right,
right. But in the book, I think Abra is much older. Like she grows up and she's like an adult. Or when the end of the book is happening, she's not just this little kid. Okay. Like it starts off when she's a kid back in the day, and then she grows up. But anyway, something like that. I don't know. Just from reading the Wikipedia, that's all I know.
Okay, you haven't read the book.
No.
No, we don't do that kind of effort on this show.
Are you kidding me? I'm going to read like some 1,000-page book to do in 1 week.
Right.
Not going to happen. But,
yeah, people have talked about wanting us to, you know, review other cultural items, TV shows or video games, and I'm just like, well, the problem is, a movie is like a 2-hour commitment that we can watch, 2.5, you know, whatever, and we can talk about it. Playing a whole video game thing or watching a whole TV series or even just a whole season, far more of a commitment, or reading a whole book. So sure. That's why we've settled for this mediocrity of what we do here.
Although I do like the idea of, if you're doing something anyway for pleasure, like if I just so happen to be reading Dr. Sleep, the novel, maybe I'll come on and I'll talk about it a bit, but.
Or
yeah, I don't know if you can.
And then seen the movie, you know.
Right. Right. But I don't think I'd ever just, oh, well, I saw the movie and now I have to read the book for the show. That's not going to happen.
All right. So we are now at the time where we are pressed against time. Allow myself to introduce myself. So why don't we get into any final points you guys want to make before we get into giving this a score, and what's an appropriate score? For how about number of demon boxes that Obi-Wan is putting the inhabitants of the Overlook into?
Yeah.
I'm fine with that. You know, the other one we could do is we're going to have bottles of Jack Daniel out of 10.
Yeah, or number of recreational vehicles in the True Knot.
Yeah, that's another good one, too. Yeah, they have a lot of recreational vehicles. You think for people who are so powerful and connected.
Some nice ones, too. Yeah, at least they were nice.
So powerful and connected, you know, you'd be like, oh, okay, well, you know, let me get a nice RV or something.
Wouldn't just be some gypsies in a clan of RVs. Yeah.
That's exactly right.
All right. So, Rob, you got any points you want to make? Any notes you got left? Or do you want to just lead off?
I just want to point out how Obi-Wan had the high ground in his battle with Rose the Hat there at the end. So that's why he won. Appreciated that little Star Wars reference.
You know,
in
was
Shining
was
movie.
Defeating her satisfactory to you, or did it leave wanting?
Well,
like
if I had,
better. I mean, he had enough shining on his own, and he should have had a little bit more. She's obviously a lot more practiced, but he's a lot more powerful, so he should have. I don't know. It's almost like Obi-Wan versus Anakin in reverse, where she's Obi-Wan, she's less powerful but more practiced, and he's Anakin, he's more powerful but less practiced. I don't know. Maybe. Yeah, you never know. You never know about these things.
Yeah, I would have appreciated her. I mean, she just seemed to be physically stronger. And well, that's because of the that was about it. Yeah. She's hundreds of years old. She should have had some tricks.
And
yeah. She's saying, well, I'm encountering this for the first time ever. It's like, okay. But you said that you've been dealing with these shining people who have been shining way more than these modern scrub shiners. So you should have come up against something similar at least, or, you know, you're practiced at dealing with shiners. These people should be, I mean, yeah, she is impressed by Danny, even though he's been dulled by the alcohol. It felt like she should have had some abilities beyond just, hey, she's physically strong.
Yeah. And then I also found that there was a little bit of disparate power levels. Like Abra impresses her so much, like she's so has so much raw power compared to Rose the Hat. Yet when Rose is chasing them, they're all like, whoa, Rose is so badass.
Mm-hmm. So like we have to set traps for her. We got to take her to the Overlook so that other people can deal with her. If she's so strong, just smack her down. What?
Yeah. But then that's not so satisfying, I suppose, because then you don't have much of a danger.
You don't, but it makes for a cleaner narrative. Like, I understand you want to build up this big heavyweight fight at the end. And as a viewer, I want to see a big heavyweight fight at the end. But it needs to make sense. And it needs to be satisfying. And it mostly was. But I still didn't quite understand. He unleashes all the Overlook ghosts and they just eat her right away. And then they eat him, I suppose. But then he's able to still talk to Abra.
Yeah, they like take him over or something and make him go after Abra, similar to Jack Torrance went after Danny.
Yeah.
But then he can sort of like overcome it briefly. And then so he's struggling with it. He's fighting it. But that didn't happen to Rose. Though Rose is one of those Death Eater things that when she gets injured sufficiently, she evaporates, right? And does that.
Right. Right.
Which, by the way, the crow guy,
uh-huh.
Crow Daddy, the defeat of Crow Daddy is, well, he's not wearing a seatbelt, so he crashes the vehicle. That is sort of like surface level clever. But I think if you're this long living being living across generations, you're going to wear a seatbelt. You're going to take care of your body because apparently they die from car accidents and falling down things and getting shot. You would think that they would be far more cautious than just an average person, knowing that otherwise they could live for generations, like hundreds of years.
Completely agree with you, sir. I thought that was a little bit cheap. Didn't make a whole lot of sense for the exact reason you just mentioned. If the risk is, it's like when a cancer patient just stops wearing their seatbelt or jumps out of an airplane for the first time ever and, you know, fills out all the bucket list stuff because
you got six months.
You got nothing to lose.
Yeah.
But you don't do that when you're 14 and you got your whole life ahead of you. You're more cautious.
You're
more cautious in that sense. Like if you think you have more to lose, you are more cautious.
Yeah. And yeah, so it felt weird to me that Crow Daddy would do such a foolish thing because they would have, in my opinion, a higher perceived risk of physical injury ending a much longer lifespan.
Right. Yeah, I don't know if that's the way he dies in the book. I'm always skeptical because it probably makes more sense in the book, but maybe not. Maybe not. Okay.
Alec, professional asshole, have you read either of these books, and do you have any insight or opinion on this?
I did, and I don't remember any specific details from the books that I could add into this. It's just going out of my mind. I got so much I got to cram in there. You know, I don't really keep a whole lot anymore. I guess I'm getting old. So, you know, anyways, but yeah, I've been packing up all my books, and man, it is a chore. It's a damn chore these days. Pack up books. I got even though I've gotten rid of like 600-700 volumes of books in the last couple of years, it's taken up maybe half my garage right now, my books.
Nice.
Can't even keep track of them anymore.
All right, Robert. Well, I think that was a sufficient last little point to discuss. So why don't you lead us off with the final summary and review and give us a number of exhalations to death or a number of recreational vehicles. Take a pick.
Yeah. What is our number out of? I like entombed ghosts, and I like the idea. This movie got me to cry when he was dealing with the what was that, the Stephen King cameo when he's one of the dead guys, he's dying. I thought that was those two scenes where the two dying guys were really nice. With a cat that would hang out with the dying people. That's a real thing that actually happens, which is kind of weird. But yeah, this movie, I think it succeeded in all the ways that The Shining failed me. I appreciate your appreciation for the original Shining, if that's indeed the way you appreciate it, in the way that it can be interpreted so many different ways. And then the way this came together, I could see your point of view on that, and I enjoy that as well. But for me, as a person that really wants to emotionally connect to a film, and how the original Shining failed so miserably at that, I didn't believe for a second that that was a loving family. I didn't believe for a second that the mother and father gave a shit about each other. So when the family broke up, you're like, good, these people all hate each other. You didn't get to see any of the good stuff before they went to the hotel and everything went to hell. Apparently King didn't like the movie for that same reason. So good on him. He knows how to tell a story. He's a freaking master. This movie succeeded for the most part, even though it's obviously going to be a trimmed down experience from the book. You're not going to get all the context and the nuance, but we spend a lot of time with Danny as an adult and how rough of a time he's having with his alcoholism and how he's trying to dull, you know, run away from his past and the horrors of all the things he sees. His mother dying with flies all over her face. Can you imagine seeing that all the time? Probably and then he's haunted by just all the things he sees. So yeah, he's a troubled soul, and he's got these powers that he doesn't want to deal with. And then he's forced to kind of reevaluate things when he meets somebody that is in the same position that he was for the most part. And he's got these villains that he's haunted by, or that are haunting her or chasing after her. And you can understand why he kind of comes out of retirement to have one last gasp, one last showdown. And it's a very satisfying, you know, typical kind of Hollywood three-act structure, but you know, there's a reason why that stuff works. And I enjoyed every minute of it. It felt like a nice, like the best X-Files movie ever without Skulder and Mulder, Mulder and Scully. I had a great time with it. Psychic vampires, sure. Throw it in there. The Shining, whatever that is, sure. Let's do it.
Dick Halloran, he's back. He was
Halloran. He was fine. He was great. I enjoyed the scenes of what was that? The Jedi's talking to each other in The Last Jedi, but in this movie, it was way better. Mm-hmm. Where the two Jedi's were like saying, "Hey, what's up?" And then they're like, "Oh, you revealed somewhere of where you are now. That was stupid of you." And it was just way better than The Last Jedi. Now they did it. So I'm going to give this, as a satisfying conclusion to the Shining saga, the story of Danny Torrance, the Overlook Hotel, how it finally burns down at the end. Apparently it's already burned down in the book, and it's like just a hangout for the crew, the evil guys there. I don't know how that all sorts out, but in this film, I thought it was a fantastic way to end it, for the most part, minor objections aside, like we talked about. But I'm going to give this 8 solid oak ghost-catching coffins. It's a lot of fun, and I would recommend it to any just movie fan. Even if you've seen The Shining before, I don't think you need to. I think it's just a good movie that you can totally get in on. I mean, you could watch the original Shining and get a little more context, but I think this movie fills you in entirely. I don't even know if you need to see the original, but you could.
Yeah, those homage callbacks do enough to establish, I think, the story, and I think that was the point. Yeah. I don't know how much after Blade Runner 2049 this came out, but that was a lot of the complaints with how poorly that did, even though it was really good, was because they didn't think the audience base was big enough to have familiarity with the original.
Okay, so
it made the 2049 like less appealing.
Mm-hmm.
But in this one, you know, they kind of replay a lot of that, and they have different actors, actresses play those roles, but they also like sort of imitate or intimate the cadence of the speech and sort of mimic how they look in some ways.
Yeah. And that didn't bother me at all. I don't know about you or anybody else, but I thought it was perfectly fine the way they did it.
I think it was the best they could have done, because anything's going to feel a little bit cheap. You know, you mm-hmm. either change them completely or you deep fake them somehow, digitize them like
right.
Skywalker, you know, when they right. younged Luke for Mandalorian.
Right.
Yeah. But yeah, so you gave it 8 stars.
Right? Eight coffins. Eight ghost coffins.
All right. So that's a good score. I was actually expecting you to give it a bit of a higher score. I was considering giving it an 8, but now just relative to you giving such a high score to something, I have to like it less. So
oh no. Oh no.
I'm gonna go with 7.25 stars on this one.
Oh.
It is a satisfying ending to not only the Kubrick version of the movie, but also the two novels, from my understanding of what they are. And it made King satisfied. However, there is some talk of doing an extension of this based on Abra and her later on in life, and some other, you know, exploits related to The Shining and adrenochrome and whatnot. But we'll see. I mean, that was all talk before the global pandemic and outsized response to that. But otherwise, a competent film with good craft in making it. Good acting. The story is straightforward enough, and it calls back sufficiently without trashing the source material or the predecessor in that I think is a cultural icon as far as horror movies go. I think that the Kubrick film stands out, and it might be one that my wife and I, we watch it almost every year. And even though we've seen the theatrical and director's cut of Dr. Sleep, we might actually make time to watch The Shining before Halloween here. So 7.25 stars from me, a valiant effort and a good way of doing the pretzel of bringing the novel and the original Shining film to a satisfactory conclusion. Working within those constraints is a bit of a genius itself, though a different level of genius than what Kubrick did in his iteration. And with that, we'll go to you, professional Alec Jones impersonator, asshole, satirical man with the plan. How are you doing over there? You got a final summary review for us?
So I have to go ahead and give this 9 stars, only because, or 9 coffins, you know, for dead people with the saggy titties and stuff. Because, you know, honestly, where do you find a film that's nearly this red-pilled? I mean, it's gargantuan in its scope, in its attempt. It's literally trying to expose people who are in power right now. The only other movie I can think of that's maybe, you know, on this level is the 1997 movie, Conspiracy Theory, with Mel Gibson, who totally 100% red pill, by the way. He's got it. He knows exactly what's going on. I gotta, of course, he's a great guy. I gotta try to keep my distance from him. But, you know, I honestly can't think of better movies in terms of telling people what's really going on in the world, in society. How people are trying to you know, keep you suppressed, depressed, you know, and enslaved. They want to keep you enslaved. And, yeah, I mean, who's doing it better? Who is revealing these truths better? You get a few documentarians out there, and they're great guys, but, you know, who in Hollywood is doing this? Right? They almost all end up dying. The only guy, maybe the other one, and was American Made with Tom Cruise, if you saw it. It was about Barry Seal, guy was doing the Iran-Contra. But even then, it's not talking about the real scope. I mean, that's just talking about typical political, you know, electioneering and engineering and so on and so forth. That's just getting into that. We're talking about the actual psychic, spiritual elements that are attacking us on a daily basis. And who's doing that in Hollywood? So, you know, I got to give it to these guys. 9 coffins.
All right. Yeah, very good. I think another one that had a lot of maybe telling red pilling is Eyes Wide Shut, which was another Kubrick film that we did a while back, though he died mysteriously before he had final cut on that one. But he was old, you know, things can happen. We also did American Made a couple of years ago, and that was a pretty good movie and a very good episode. So I'll find that and put it on the old show notes page down below, along with all your prior appearances there, Alec, professional asshole Jones in a satirical sense, half brother to fake half brother to Alex Jones. So people can find that at lastnerd.com/200 for show notes and more, and also Patreon bonus content at lastnerd.com/Patreon. And Robert, next week we are going to continue the horror theme. And we're going to do John Carpenter, and there's a lot of options we could choose from.
Oh, uh-huh. Yeah, he's got all kinds of good stuff.
The one we landed on is Prince o' Darkness, mostly because it's free on the old Peacock network. We talked about Peacock last week, where you just watch a couple of ads and you can watch the full-on movie. And what we do is we turn the volume all the way down, dim the screen. It says, all right, 300 seconds of ads, and then you can watch the movie. So we just like 300 seconds of boop, silence, and then we watch the movie. So Prince of Darkness, and hopefully, I haven't nailed this down yet, but hopefully the guest will be the indomitable Wilson Hader himself, Prof. CJ of the Dangerous History Podcast, who also happens to be a big John Carpenter fan, as was our prior guest, Snobby Bobby of the Not For Everyone Podcast. He's a big Carpenter fan as well. So Carpenter fans all around, a sandwich of them, with the meat being professional asshole tonight in our sandwich. So thank you, Alec, for joining us. It's been a lot of fun. I hope you can stick around a little bit longer for, what do we call it? We call it Kathleen Turner Overdrive, but what does your brother Alex call it when he's doing the bonus content, continuing after the break?
Tranny Porn Central.
That works too. All right. So people can find the show notes for this at lastnerd.com/200. And we'll see you guys all next week for Prince of Darkness. And stick around for some Kathleen Turner Overdrive right after this. And with that, we'll say good night from last night, everyone. Peace out. All right, and continuing the actual Anarchy podcast for a few more minutes, our guest, professional asshole, also Alec Jones, a.k.a. identifying as, because we have you on, I'm going to get a little conspiratorial.
And one, all right, go ahead. I love it.
One of those conspiracies is that the elites are so full of hubris, but also have some sort of a code in which they need to telegraph or tell us what they're doing and be open about it. Do you think that movies like this that depict child sacrifice and things like that is them sort of admitting these things into the culture in a way, but with enough plausible deniability to say, oh, that's fiction. It's a movie. It's a thing. It's a whatever. But it satisfies whatever code they might believe that they need to satisfy to be able to then, I don't know, have consent into doing the things that they're doing.
Well, I don't know if they're leaking it because they want to try to get catharsis or assent or whatever. I think they're leaking it because, I agree with the hubris part. They are so hubristic that they can't help but do this because they're not looking for permission. They don't care about permission. If they killed all of us, they wouldn't even bat an eye. They're when I call them lizard people, it's because like lizards, they don't have tear glands. They don't care. They're psychopaths. I'd say the issue is more that.
Is it like a. We're putting it in your face. We're showing you what we're doing and laughing about it.
Yeah, I think that's more what I agree with. It's that they're laughing about it, not knowing that they're telegraphing their punches. You know? Mm. And so, I mean.
It's a tell.
The fact that they are powerful enough to do that is can give you a little bit of pause, but ultimately, if they're telegraphing their punches, it means that we have options to hit them back. And we got to do it. We got to do it. You know?
Yeah, well, that's the one thing that I've heard bandied about recently was if they were so confident in the that they were going to win this thing, the propaganda wouldn't be necessary.
Yeah. I mean, the propaganda is definitely part of like the PSYOP stuff. Because, I mean, yes, they cannot do this on their own. They need willing participants. They need the blue pills. They need the blue pills in order to go run the factories and do all the stuff. Sometimes they are of the opinion that they don't need nearly as many people as they need. They seem to think they can get away with, half a billion people on the planet. And, you could maybe run things, with half a billion people if they were only in, like, say, America, right? And the rest of the world was just wilderness, right? But that the problem is that the human brain is a magnificent thing. It is a conduit for new ideas, for new ideas, for all these wonderful things. And you gotta, I don't know, it's a matter of getting, it's a matter of getting new and better ideas. The more people we have, the more new, better ideas we have, right? And that's because, in my opinion, people as spiritual beings are pulling in God's ideas into reality.
Okay. So I have a couple of follow-ups, and they're related to quotes. One is Solzhenitsyn, where he says, "We know they're lying, they know they're lying, and yet they continue to lie." And it that ties into a Theodore Dalrymple quote, which is along similar lines, in that they do the propaganda not because they want to convince you that the propaganda is true. They do it to demoralize you, to let you know that they can say these things that are so obviously untrue and yet present them as the reality.
No, he's got 100% right.
I'm paraphrasing, yeah. Of course. But that sort of flies into the face of the, well, if the propaganda, if we were going to win, the propaganda wouldn't be necessary or whatever, right? If that's their thinking.
And that Malice guy, like, he calls that the white pill. And that's his theory about how it's the white pill. And, I mean, I'm not sure. You know, it's sometimes very difficult not to be depressed. But ultimately, the human spirit cannot be subdued. And even if it takes thousands of years, human beings, they want freedom. They want their spiritual satisfaction. They're not going to be satisfied with just these. They're not going to be satisfied living life in a box, eating bug meat.
So hard times will bring about good men again.
Yep, that's right.
Okay, so I think we got a dark winter ahead of us. That's
unfortunately, that may be the case, but we'll see. I mean, it really depends. You know, there's a lot of good people in America, but you know, there's also a lot of bad people, too. We got to take them out.
All right. Well, very good. Well, thank you again for being our guest. We'll have the show notes with all of your prior appearances. And I think we're going to have you self-identify with another voice identity in the post-show content, Kathleen Turner Overdrive, in just a few moments here. But people can find the show notes and more for this at actualanarchy.com/257 and get the Patreon bonus content at actualanarchy.com/Patreon. And we will see you guys all next week for Prince of Darkness with Prof. CJ of the Dangerous History Podcast. And it'll be a spooky Halloween episode, or close to it. And with that, we will say maximum freedom, everyone. And we'll see you guys next week. Peace out.
Chipmunks. CHIPMUNK. We're the chipmunks. Guaranteed to brighten your day. Do, 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 do.